Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a special program, a different program. Science is a big operation, and federal government has a big hand in the money that supports science, both education and research. And so big organizations like, for example, the American Chemical Society, with 150,000 approximately members all over the world, needs to keep tabs on what the federal government is doing. And for that particular purpose, it has an office called the Office of Public Affairs. And within that, there's a group of people doing what is called politely advocacy. And to translate that into English, lobbyists. And so today we're going to be talking with Ryan Davison, Dr. Ryan Davison. He's a holder of a PhD, as I imply, been a researcher. Now he works for the ACS up on Capitol Hill, advocating on behalf of science and innovation, technology transfer, and things of that nature. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. Nice to be here.
Before we get into your role as an advocate, as a lobbyist, how did you become a scientist? What were those sort of formative years and made you think about science as a career?
Yes, thanks. I guess everyone with a science background has their own interesting path. Mine started, I actually liked psychology, so studying behavior, but it's so difficult to actually get answers when you're trying to understand human behavior. But a lot of people in psychology wander over to neuroscience because it's kind of the harder scientific side of psychology. And I earned a master's degree in experimental psychology, running rats through mazes and then tinkering with their brains and running them through the same mazes to see how they would do spatial navigation in different ways. And that led me to a PhD in neuroscience, where I recorded motor neurons in awake behaving primates, which is in itself quite a technique. You isolate a single neuron and record its firing rate when the animal is doing a variety of different things. It was fascinating. But I spent a good bit of my spare time, all my free time, obsessed with politics and, okay, you know, on cable news and reading blogs and things. So at some point, I realized I love science, but some of us can make a bigger impact out of the laboratory. Right? That there's those people that cure diseases or really move the field a good bit. And I wasn't feeling like I was going to do that.
So, and you didn't have a particular passion like some of us that, you know, we're interested in politics, but, you know, there's this little corner of the garden where we like to grow roses. In our case, it's not roses, but, you know, like in my case, silicon chemistry. And this is a passion. But in your case, you realized that, you know, you wanted to make an impact beyond and above the roses, so to speak.
Yes, sir. And, yeah, and having a science background in moving into policy is not a bad thing.
It's
a
field. I think it's highly commendable,
right,
and needed.
Yes,
in fact,
it's a field full of a lot of lawyers and business people. Yes. So it gave me a unique perspective, and hopefully I can offer a different kind of view of things. Yes.
Before we get into that different view, let's just go back to the firing of the neurons and the rate. Is it, as one might expect, the more agitated or excited, the faster the neurons were clicking away, or is it that simple?
Yes, sir. These were like little robots. So motor neurons, as a muscle contracts, they increase their firing rate, and as a muscle relaxes, they fire less. And the part of the brain I was recording in was the ocular motor nucleus, which is really neat. So you're slowly lowering an electrode into the primate midbrain. And as you approach it, it sounds, you have an electrode and it's amplified so you can hear.
You're listening to the firing.
You're listening. You're in a dark room listening to it.
Lovely.
It's really straight out of a Stanley Kubrick movie, it felt like.
Okay.
As you approach the nucleus, it sounds like you're walking up to a large beehive. So you'll hear, and it's as the eyes are moving, all of the cells coordinated, they increase or decrease their firing. They can fire up to 600-700 action potentials per second, which as neurons go is really fast, and they can then drop down to 20 a second. So it sounds.
And when they were sleeping, it's still cracking.
They were awake, yes.
They're always awake.
Yes, sir. We had them looking at different things for an apple juice reward. So the primates were really interested, and we'd put the glasses on them, and they'd look all over a screen, and we would record the eye position, the acceleration, the everything, and try and map this motor system.
What was the basic fundamental discovery that you made for your thesis?
I haven't talked about this in a long time, so I'm going back. We found that there were two separate pathways, neural pathways, that control when the eyes move in the same direction versus when they move in different directions. So in one sentence, that would be my 7 years of
– I'm trying to think here. If I'm looking at you with one eye, I'm trying to look out the corner.
I can explain. And if anyone listening, if you put a finger in front of your face and you move it side to side, your eyes move in the same direction, slowly together. These are called smooth pursuit eye movements. And it's what goes on in the brain for your eyes to be able to track a moving object is really complicated. If you then take the same finger, put it in front of your nose and move it closer to your eyes, these are called vergence eye movements, and the eyes move in different directions. They have to move, right?
To maintain the
exactly. And so there are two distinct neural pathways controlling the eyes when they do those two different things.
And you could distinguish these and have fun with this.
Have fun would be one way to describe it, yes.
Okay. But it was enough fun to get a PhD.
It was.
Do a postdoc.
But then
you landed up in Washington, as I gather.
Yes, sir.
And then you got the chance to take a fellowship.
Yes. There's a couple ways a scientist can transition into policy work. The two ways I speak about most are there's fellowship programs. The National Academy of Sciences, which you probably know is a prestigious place to be a member as a researcher, they have a fellowship program where they take – twice a year they take about 30 PhDs, and they will place them in one of the National Academy Institutes. So the Institute of Medicine, I was in the National Academy of Engineering, and so they place you there for a few months and you learn the ins and outs, I guess, of some policy issues. The other program is the AAAS, has a one-year
– American Association for the Advancement of Science.
That's right. I need to remember to not use the acronyms. You assume everybody knows that. That's a one-year fellowship also that – it's bigger. They take, I think, 150, 200 PhDs a year, and they keep them for 1 year and will put them at some federal agency. You could work at the NIH, the DOE, the Department of Defense. So those are the two most common ways that people with science and technical backgrounds that want to move into policy do so. You can also, in an old-fashioned way, just go work for a member of Congress. They're not always paid positions. So even with a PhD, you may have to suck it up and go be an unpaid intern.
So these will be rich kids.
Or someone that's saved really well. Yes. Yes. But it's hard to live in a city like D.C. with no income.
Yeah, I can imagine. Difficult to live anywhere with no income. Yeah,
right?
So then that's quite a number, 100 here, 100 there. And so
they're very competitive, though. There's thousands that apply. They're not easy to get.
Let's talk about you. You did one of those fellowships, and then you're saying, well, now what do I do? The fellowships run out.
That's right. That's exactly right. It took me – I worked at a NIH advocacy place called Research America. I was a postdoc at Georgetown collecting data for a friend of mine. I taught neuroscience at George Washington University. I volunteered for free at a biosecurity place to get some experience. So after finishing the fellowship – for about 10 months, I worked crazy hours.
Scratching away
for very little money, trying to find a permanent position. And serendipity had it, I ended up at the American Chemical Society. And most of the people that I do advocacy with, they don't have science backgrounds.
I mean, that's one of the issues that I think is unfortunate, right? I mean, I may be wrong on that.
Well, let me say, if I could take someone that had worked on Capitol Hill for 10 years or had been a researcher for 10 years, the experience, the political experience is very valuable because the people you're working with, they don't really want to know the science at the level that a professional knows it. So it can be a detriment in some ways. You take a PhD that wants to – they've been doing the same type of work for 7, 8 years and you say, well, you have 30 seconds. Go an inch deep and a mile wide. Don't get into your data analysis or all the stuff you love. So in some sense, having a political experience may make you more adept at working with the type of people we do.
That's interesting. So the political experience trumps the depth of knowledge of a science.
You can teach someone a little bit of science,
right.
Sometimes easier than you can teach a scientist a little bit of
political correctness.
Yes,
I can believe that completely.
Right, right.
And most of these people in the fellowships, do they get positions like yours, or how many are there, for goodness sake?
That's a good question. Some go back to academia. Right. Some stay in D.C. and develop policy careers. So it really it goes both ways. Yeah,
okay.
I've seen both.
So now, why does the American Chemical Society need advocates, lobbyists?
That's a good question. The ACS, the American Chemical, there are many different groups in Washington that are fighting for different things. And the American Chemical Society, for basic fundamental research, we are the biggest group by far. It's the world's largest scientific society. But you'll find there's a lot of groups that advocate for the NIH, for curing diseases or clinical research. It's a little harder to try and fight for interests that take time to – you know how fundamental research works. It's over a period of time. You have to – you consider it an investment.
Yeah. Oh, it's a career.
Of course it is.
Right.
Of
and course at the end of it, you look back and, you know, you see that you've done this, 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 and this, and then your grandmother says, and what difference has that made?
Right.
And you say, grandmother, that's not the right question.
And when you have members in the House of Representatives that they have an election every 2 years,
right.
It's challenging to explain to them science, research, this is an investment, and you may not see a return in 8 months, in 14 months. So.
It'd be impossible almost.
Right. So I would say the ACS, we represent basic research, fundamental research for the scientific community in D.C. like no other group does.
Right.
And yeah.
I mean, one of the other products, I mean, I'm very conscious of this dichotomy between growing my roses, doing my work on silicon or whatever, molybdenum, and, you know, sometimes it comes up with a result that might be potentially useful in catalysis, for example. But most of the time, it doesn't. All right. Most scientists, especially in academia, where you can choose to work on what you want as opposed to what your company needs, you know, much less likely to suddenly become a gizmo, you know, something useful for society. But then I fall back on the argument says, but of course, you don't recognize I've trained, you know, 125 students who have gone out there and work in industry and do this, that and the other. And in fact, that's probably easier argument to give to politicians that we've trained a large number of students who are now out there in industry as opposed to coming back into the ivory tower where I am.
Absolutely. When the economy contracted, the argument – the science community would try and justify increased funding levels. I mean, that was the talking points for a long time. But then when we were seeing cuts to defense and military – type places, that argument didn't work anymore. So we had to change anything with job growth or economic strength.
Manpower for the future.
Sure. That's what lawmakers respond to best now and have over the past few years. So we try and make those arguments.
Now, do you have a specialty? Because you're not the only lobbyist that the American Chemical Society has up in D.C., I think.
Yes, Keith. I manage the innovation portfolio, which covers a variety of things. We have a specialist in green energy and the environmental issues. We have a STEM education specialist. And we kind of all juggle different – it's hard sometimes to guess what will be an issue or what bills will arise. So as a team, we cover everything pretty nicely, I hope.
Yeah. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm talking with Dr. Ryan Davison, advocate for the American Chemical Society, i.e. he's a lobbyist, up in D.C., in charge of innovation and tech transfer. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ryan Davison. Now he works for the ACS up on Capitol Hill, advocating on behalf of science and innovation, technology transfer, and things of that nature. And Ryan, you were telling us about your role up in D.C. with a sort of a portfolio for innovation and tech transfer. So what does that mean? What do you do?
Sure. Well, innovation's a sexy word, right, that covers lots of things. And that can cover – I guess I can tell you a couple of the main things I'm working on right now. Innovation, we need incentives for innovation, right? The United States used to be better at this, but we're getting beat by other countries. And so there is the – one of the best innovations we have is the research and development tax credit This was an innovation incentive that started in 1981 under Ronald Reagan's economic reform plans. But the problem with it is it was only legislated to last a few years, and it expires every couple years, and Congress has to renew it. And what the bill really does is each year that a company spends more money than the previous year, they get a tax break. Pure and simple. So,
but you've got to spend more than previous year.
More than the previous
fiscal
year. 100
units this year.
Exactly. Exactly.
98 next year.
Don't get it. So it's a pure innovation incentive. It's a really nice incentive. It's currently expired. It expired at the end of 2014. We expect at the end of this year for it to be extended maybe another year or two, back extended for a year. But there's a number of tax credits for clean energy tax credits, wind, and they're supposed to be incentives for industry and companies to invest more R&D in the United States. And they're not becoming that.
They're almost an expectation now then, right?
Yes. Maybe 1 year over the past few, the R&D tax credit wasn't – it stayed expired the entire year. So it's just – the purpose of it is to be an incentive.
Hang on. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't extended. So it was killed effectively. It just
that
didn't
one,
operate that
I
year.
I think it was 96. I can't remember.
And so the American Chemical Society, on behalf, in a sense, of its industrial component, because this doesn't really have much of an impact on the university environment. So you're looking at the big chemical companies. These are the people who say, well, come on, ACS, what are you doing? Where's Ryan when we need him? You
know? Yes. We are part of a coalition of many Fortune 500 companies, and this is a issue for the business community quite a bit. So we work with – that's a nice example. We do many things with the academic side and industry side, and these innovation incentives, we work pretty closely with the business community.
Let's talk about the tech transfer, because this is – I've had people working in my group, postdocs, graduate students, gone off to work with innovative small companies, made significant advances, some important patents that have attracted a lot of attention around the world from different organizations, companies, and they see this patent and they think, oh, damn, you know, we need to be involved with that. But they don't want to license it because then you're just having to spend money. So they buy the company, which means they buy the patents. And I can tell you, a small company up in Colorado, one of my ex-researchers, made some tremendous advances. Yeah, I'm not going to go into the area. And then all of a sudden, a big company in Japan says, oh, we like that, buys the company, comes over and works with the people for a year, year and a half, learns all the secret art of doing whatever the patent was about, and then, whoosh, closes the whole thing down. Now, I know that's free enterprise, but it seems to me that that is not the way free enterprise should be somehow working. Is the ACS and yourself and people in your group concerned with that type
of
activity?
Sure. Protecting intellectual property is an important component to any development. I'm from the great state of Florida, and we have Gatorade as that seems to be the gold standard, where the scientists at the University of Florida developed this drink with electrolytes to help the football team, the Florida Gators, stop the players from passing out on the hot Florida fields, and it's turned into a billion-dollar company. So I guess if maybe listeners don't know, tech transfer is when a researchers, scientists develop a commercial product at a university, and there's the issues of who has the rights to the intellectual property. And often if you're an employee of the university, you have to work through the university's technology transfer program to get a product to market. And it's different. Different states have different regulations about this. Different universities do, whether it's public or private.
Right.
So, the issue is a complex one. And in the best case scenarios, the researchers can be compensated, and the university, if a product makes money at a business, everyone wins.
To the particular issue that I brought up, when a foreign organization, or any, I suppose, buys out the company because they want the patent and then closes it down, you know, somehow there should be some international law that says this is totally unacceptable.
It sounds morally difficult. Yeah, your specific question might be kind of above my area of expertise. For international. I mean, I know securing intellectual property, we have issues with some in Korea that they will. There's been cases of buying a high tech piece of equipment and then back engineering it to figure out how it works and then just making it themselves. So I know I've met with some employees of small businesses here in the U.S. and they often will start plants in another country just to make sure what's going on there is within the practices of their company to make sure
to defend themselves.
I guess, in a sense, yes.
It's a
yes.
complex system.
It is a very complex.
I can't even begin to get my head around
yes,
it. Tell us some of the successes that you've had yourself since you – how long have you been up there?
I've been there. I just recently had my five-year anniversary.
At the end of 5 years, that's like when you get tenure at a university. So what's your portfolio? What have you done to deserve having this position?
Thanks. Well, we have some victories. We have a lot of losses, I'm afraid, too. It's a tough Congress since – 2010 was the Tea Party wave moved into, and it kind of paralyzed spending. So I'm happy to say, as we did last year, it looks like this year we have secured a Senate resolution recognizing the importance of National Chemistry Week. We have a letter from the White House also recognizing National Chemistry Week to help us promote the events associated with it. So that doesn't sound like much, but to get even something simple like a Senate resolution, you have to find a Democrat and a Republican senator that will co-sponsor a resolution, and then it has to receive a vote in the Senate and have no one object to it.
Who were our senators?
Oh, yes, sir. Senator Chris Coons from Delaware, a good friend of the ACS, and Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania was the co-sponsor.
So they're our chemist allies up there. I want to hear two things. I want to hear a tangible success apart from that one.
Okay.
And then an area where you really are battling hard and don't seem to make much progress. So let's go to the negative news before we can finish on a high.
Okay, I can give you an example of each of those. If you saw in the news in 2010, there's an agency in D.C., the government, GSA. They had a meeting in Las Vegas with their employees. And basically, they exist to save the taxpayers' money. They had a meeting where
– oh, this is the one where they spent a lot
of money. They spent about $900,000 on psychics and clowns, and just – it was a mess. The director tweeted out a photo in his bathtub with some very expensive glasses of wine. And long story short, Congress got wind of, look at this agency spending, wasting taxpayer money on. Now it was a good chunk of money, but in the big picture, it was a drop in the bucket. But politically, it sold really well. So a number of bills started to develop that restricted federal employees from being able to travel to conferences or conventions or meetings. Now, as you know, personally, from science, it's so collaborative. This is really bad. Myself, as a graduate student, you would go to a scientific meeting, give a poster presentation, and you would have senior scientists come over and help you understand what it meant, what you were doing. Right. So the spirit of these bills, there's been a number now in the House and the Senate, is to restrict wasteful government spending. But it has threatened the collaborative nature of scientific meetings. So we've been fighting quite a bit over the past few years.
Were they trying to restrict people with federal research grants from using that for travel? Or
well,
was this
employees? They've scared the agencies into wanting to spend any money on sending their employees to conferences.
Yeah.
But they've actually tried to restrict it. One bill was no more than 50 federal employees could attend a meeting. Now, this would be from the DOE, the NSF, the NIH. In other cases, they wanted to make anything that occurred at a meeting had to be publicly posted on a website within a week or two. You could imagine if you were giving a talk with unpublished data or, say, a patent you were working on, how bad this is for science and research.
Right.
So we've had a few successes in stopping the restriction. So that would be an example of defensive lobbying, where you're just trying to stop something bad from happening.
Okay, all right. And we were talking last night over a drink about the helium.
Sure.
Tell us about
helium. Yes, that's a good example of a success. Helium is used in a number of scientific equipment, in MRIs, LCDs. It's actually very prevalent in chemistry and physics departments. But helium is expensive, and it's a finite resource. So
I mean, for the people listening, the main use for laypersons is magnetic resonance imaging.
That's right.
You need
that's
to
right.
go as a low,
coolant,
low, low temperature,
and it can stay liquid.
Superconducting
that's right.
magnets that do all those good analyses on your gut or your whatever.
That's right. And we use a lot of it, and it's not efficiently recycled. So you have to buy a lot of helium, and it's almost a one-time use kind of deal. It bleeds off.
Yeah,
into
I mean, that's an interesting the concept of recycling helium.
We're working on that.
I mean, its boiling point is about 4 degrees absolute or something.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so that's interesting.
Well, to give you the victory, in 2013, the biggest helium reserve, which is here in Texas in Amarillo, it was set to shut down. It had been previously picked as a date in a previous bill to shut it down, and I think it was October 2013. And as this creeped up, it looked like this was going to be a serious problem because researchers all over the country, it was going to spike in price and just be difficult to
ruin
obtain.
Lots of birthday parties.
that's what everybody thinks, right? In balloons.
Terrible use of helium.
Right. That's really not what we use it for. But I'm happy to say the ACS, along with some other scientific communities, we fought pretty hard to keep the helium reserve to stay open. And since then, our efforts have been highlighted in Wired magazine, and the ACS has received a lot of really positive press about our work on the helium issue.
Science is it's fun, you know, but it's useful. It's constantly producing new ideas, which come out in the end to new products through all sorts of technological advances. Hey, we've got to finish.
Okay.
Brian Davison.
Thank you. We can go for another hour easily.
Oh, yeah, we can. You can advocate to the public radio station here. The Science Studio should be 1 hour long now.
Yes, sir.
Right? And I'd like to thank DJ Orozco for managing to put this program together. And, of course, I'd like to thank you out there listening. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.